We're going to start the program today with a conversation with Sash Sankara, founder and CEO of Rackware. Sash, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I look forward to the conversation.
So tell us about Rackware. What do you do?
So Rackware is, we're a software company. We've been around since 2009, and what we do is we are building a cloud management suite for enterprises to be able to leverage either public clouds like Amazon, Azure, Google, IBM, or private clouds such as OpenStack, and in some cases around the world, CloudStack. So basically, what the vision was to enable enterprises with the complexity that they have in their existing data centers today with all of those applications to be able to leverage the agility of the cloud. So we do things like migrating workloads into the cloud. We do things like disaster recovery. So disaster recovery is becoming a hot topic because obviously we all live in the world today. We have a lot more events, whether they're weather-wise or just events, you know, caused by people, that we have to, you know, make sure that people have a good DR plan. However, economically, people do not want to spend large amounts of money building redundant data centers. So what we allow our clients to do is take their entire data center, move it into the cloud, and if, you know, some event happens, we can automatically fail them over. We're also doing things like hybrid cloud management in that, you know, folks are saying, hey, we don't want to go to one cloud. It's not going to be all Amazon. We want to have a hybrid strategy. Some of our applications are going to be internal. Some of them are going to be in Amazon. Some will be in Google. Some will be in IBM. They can use the cloud management layer from IBM to manage all of those types of resources.
And what is the genesis of this idea? What is your background? How does that tie into what you're doing? How did you come up with the decision that this is the problem that you were going to work on?
Yeah, so it's funny that it's a really good question because, you know, when I wanted to start a company from scratch, it wasn't necessarily I was going to go in my area of expertise. I was going to go into a different space. But it's fairly challenging if you don't have the experience, you know, and the knowledge from a particular area. So I kind of went back to, you know, where I sort of, you know, grew up as an engineer, which was the enterprise. So I started my career at Hewlett-Packard. You know, we built, you know, printing on the network. We built networking hubs, networking routers, and things like that. And, you know, cards that allowed you to put your printers on the network. From there, I moved on to Brocade, which was the storage area networking leader. And, you know, they had a pretty good stranglehold on the enterprise. So myself and Todd Matters, who's my co-founder, we have a pretty strong background in the enterprise. And in 2008, you know, we saw sort of Amazon coming out with Elastic Cloud, and, you know, the buzzwords were all around. This idea had existed, right? The idea of having agile resources, on-demand resources, capacity on demand. But with Amazon coming out, it started to really take hold in the marketplace. However, enterprises have a different problem in that they have very complex environments, complex configurations that have been put together over time, and a lot of investment has gone into configuring, testing, and qualifying and hardening these environments. It was not going to be easy for them to move into the cloud, nor was it going to be easy to leverage the elasticity and the on-demand nature of cloud. So Todd and I, with our backgrounds, you know, heavy in the enterprise, you know, our goal was to build that bridge. You know, how did enterprises today, you know, take advantage of the cloud? So that was sort of, you know, where our expertise came in. My expertise is in operating systems, virtualization, server technologies, and storage. And Todd has a very strong, you know, background in the networking space. So with that put together, we're able to build a technology that takes some of the most challenging applications, Oracle databases, SAP, Exchange, SharePoint, et cetera, and be able to leverage existing public and private cloud platforms.
So how did you get the company off the ground?
Yeah, so, you know, this wasn't my first startup. You know, I had been at a couple of other startups before in product management roles, executive roles, and things like that. So when Todd and I came together late 2008, we knew we wanted to do one more startup. We knew we wanted to do it together. And, you know, so however, at the time, if you remember, the economy was not doing very well. You know, when the bank failures were happening, the bail election, it's a lot of turmoil. And in Silicon Valley, you know, we had, you know, VCs like Sequoia, you know, sending out memos saying, no new investments, we're going to hold our funds for our existing portfolios. And that really kind of took hold. However, we thought we had a great idea. You know, we really believed in the technology. We really believed in building this bridge for enterprises. We really believed that, you know, enterprises could escape the four walls of their data center and should be able to leverage, you know, resources anywhere, any cloud, any geography, et cetera. However, where were we going to get the money? So we said, let's go find a strategic partner. Let's find somebody that can potentially use this idea and be able to, you know, fund us at least until sort of the economic climate change. So we did end up finding a strategic partner. We ended up signing a deal with them in 2010, and it was basically a storage company, LSI, and they wanted to use it for specifically one of their product lines that they wanted to launch in the channel. So they gave us, you know, a couple $1 million, and we ended up building a small team, built out, you know, the product, and we were about to launch, and then our strategic partner got acquired. Good news for us, we wrote the agreement in a way that, you know, if either party got acquired, you know, the other party could terminate. So, you know, we spent the money already, we were able to sort of terminate the relationship, but we didn't have to give up any equity. The good news was we had a product, we had some very early customers, and, you know, but we didn't have any more runway, so we really had to find more customers and find some revenue to be able to keep the company going.
So what was what were the intellectual property terms when LSI gave you this $2 million? Was it understood that the new company that you were starting would own all the intellectual property of your work?
That's a great question. Yes. That's one of the important things to remember, you know, as you're building your company. IP is everything. You know, it's IP, it's the team, and it's the product. So how we built it is with the funds they gave us, you know, they got to put, you know, have some input into the roadmap and product definitions. They didn't control it. They got to have input, and we obviously had to build some features for them. And we built some exclusivity in it for them for a certain amount of time. So there was a term associated with the exclusivity that we couldn't sell the product elsewhere. It was worth the trade-off for us in getting the funds and building the early product and really having the freedom to go, put the product out there, learn, harden the product, really understand how it, you know, took to scale without having to go broadly into the market, which typically happens when you're raising VC money very early on, the pressure's on, the clock started. So this kind of worked out for us in that, you know, we got some early funding. Yes, we had to give up some exclusivity, but, you know, they also gave us some marketing funds to go get some customers, to go really try out the product, what was working, what wasn't. So we kind of made some tweaks in the early days that really have paid off, you know, now that we made some right decisions at that point. However, when, you know, LSI went away, you know, we had to go find some money, and, you know, we didn't want to just live off of revenue. You know, as most entrepreneurs know, revenue's great, bootstrapping is great, but it's bumpy. You know, it's, you know, and so we wanted to sort of have a little bit more funding at that point so we could build out the team, work on our roadmap, and kind of extend the product. So that's when, you know, we decided, hey, it's time to go out and raise some venture money at that point.
So the LSI $2 million was revenue. It was structured as revenue, not as any kind of equity or debt financing.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So by the time you went out to raise your first round of financing, you had this $2 million in revenue, and your customer had been acquired, but was the customer still a customer? Were they still?
No. Yeah, so it was still structured as revenue. The customer wasn't a customer any longer because the acquirer network appliance was going in a different direction with the product. So, you know, though we had the revenue, we weren't going to see any follow-on business. However, we did have some other customers. You know, we had some business with SunGard in the early days. We had some business with CenturyLink, Savvis at that time, and we had some business with the government as well. So we had some revenue and we had some follow-on business, and we had, you know, some recurring as well. So, you know, we had more than just a pitch. You know, we had a product that worked. We had a product that scaled, and we had some early revenue. So we started our road into raising money at the end of 2012.
Okay. And then what? How much did you raise in that first round?
Yeah, so, you know, so typically, you know, I've been in startups before, and typical Sand Hill, you know, startups tend to raise fairly large rounds in the first Series A. And I didn't want to. I wanted to go a different route. I really wanted to raise enough to get us some runway to build out the business, to acquire more customers, and really, and then potentially go out and raise more money. So I didn't want to go for a large VC, typical Kleiner Perkins or Sequoia. I wanted to find a boutique firm that would more align with our objectives of it's going to be about revenue, it's going to be about customers, and it isn't just going to be about raising money. So we decided we wanted to target a $3 million round. We started at the end of 2012. And the other thing is we ended up deciding to go outside of Silicon Valley. You know, we didn't feel that the climate was great. You know, I was in California. My co-founder was in the East Coast. That's not usually, you know, really, you know, a lot of VCs don't like the geographical separation of founders, so it's a challenge here. And I found a bit of a bias in Silicon Valley. So I ended up going to Salt Lake City, and I ended up meeting Gavin Christensen and his fund, Kickstart Seed Fund, which has grown significantly over the last, you know, 4 years. And he ended up giving us a term sheet in early 2013. We left the round open. We wanted to fill out the round to raise the three. And we were introduced to Osage Ventures out in the East Coast, where my co-founder was. And they're really well known in that area, one of the top tier firms in Philadelphia. So he really liked the pitch. They're a big enterprise software investor, and we ended up closing the $3 million round in June of 2013.
And what, these firms that you mentioned, Kickstart Seed Fund and the Philadelphia Fund, how did you zero in on these particular funds? Why them? So I understand your logic of why you said you decided to go outside of Silicon Valley, but why specifically these funds?
Yeah, so one of our early customers prior to venture funding was Farallon Research. They were working with the Department of Defense and the government, the federal government, about going into the public cloud. You know, what are the security implications? How do we deal with our aging infrastructure? And they really had a good experience with us as far as the product, as well as myself and Todd. And they knew we were targeting raising around. So one of the partners there said, look, you know what, I know a great firm in Salt Lake City. And by the way, as far as recruiting and, you know, bringing on developers, I think, you know, Salt Lake City is going to be a great place to do that with BYU and their excellent computer science program, as well as the University of Utah. You know, we thought this was a great area, not only to raise money, but also to, you know, to build a facility or to have one of our offices. We do have offices in Salt Lake City, and one of the partners of Farallon knew Gavin quite well. I was a little hesitant. I didn't know much about Salt Lake City. I didn't have a lot of experience there. But as soon as I met Gavin and his partners, it really was great synergy. I met their, you know, steering committee. There was a lot of great synergy there. So as soon as we met, you know, we hit it off. We felt like we were going to align on objectives. We spent a lot of time on that. That's one of the other things I was going to say. It's not just about raising money. The board members that you choose, the investors that you choose, they're going to be with you all the way. You want to make sure that you can work well together and that your objectives are aligned of what you want to accomplish. And I felt Gavin and I had a great rapport. I knew we would have a good long-term relationship. So that really was, you know, some of the things that I was looking for. So that's why Salt Lake City. As far as Osage, you know, we have today a Philadelphia office. My co-founder is from Philly, and so, you know, we knew that we wanted to continue to grow there as well. And again, we're a little different. We have a lot of offices, so it was a challenge at the beginning, but we really kind of, I feel like we've nailed how to do offices in quite a few geographies. So anyway, so.
Would you say you're kind of running a virtual company?
Not really. So we have our headquarters here in Silicon Valley today. We have, over 40 people here. We have a pretty large organization in Salt Lake City. And then, you know, we have more of a sales office in Philadelphia. And then we have obviously developers in Pune. You know, I think with any startup, you know, as old as we are, you're going to have separate offices. You're going to have sales offices.
So it's not fine. So you have 40 people in Silicon Valley. How many in Salt Lake City?
I want to say a little over 10.
And what about Pune? How many in Pune?
Oh, wow. I think 25.
Okay. All right. So that gives us an idea about the distribution and center of gravity of the company. So then what happened after you got that $3 million? By the way, folks, those of you who are listening, I want to give you a bit of context. You see, what's happening in the venture capital industry is that as funds become successful, they're raising larger and larger funds. So if you, as you hear about those big name venture funds, the Kleiners and the Sequoias, the Benchmarks and the Andreessen Horowitz and so forth, they're all becoming very large funds. And the draw for VCs to raise large funds is because they get paid a lot in management fees. And so it's very difficult for a large fund to invest small amounts of money in early stage ventures. So a Series A round with a larger fund is going to be a larger round. But very often we see, even in our work in general, we see a lot of companies who want to raise a smaller round, even if it's a Series
right.
A, a 2 to 3 million Series A, is something that these large firms are not structured to do. So you're going to need to work with a different set of firms, and they exist. They exist in Silicon Valley. They exist elsewhere. These funds are willing to do $1 to $3 million Series A rounds, and that's where you you find those kinds of investors who are more interested in the capital efficient entrepreneurship model. Because part of what you're going to think through as you're deciding on your funding strategy is, you know, if you take on a huge amount of venture funding, you're going to have to deliver exits that are commensurate to large funding and, larger valuations. Large funding means often larger valuations, and you have to up that in your exit. And, you know, it's not easy to build these hyper fast growth companies and deliver very large exits. There are, as it is, there aren't that many exits in the industry. So these are all nuances of funding strategy that you have to keep in mind. In general, in 1 million by 1 million, our broad strategy is to do capital efficient entrepreneurship, not take too much money. We have had companies who have raised a huge amount of money. But for the large majority of the companies out there, capital efficient entrepreneurship is how you are going to create a lot more personal wealth than going out there raising huge amounts of money and then flaming out. All right, back to Sash. So let's talk about the next stage of evolution in after the first round of funding, what happened?
So after the first round of funding, it was interesting because we really had sort of the early money from LSI, and we sort of lived off, you know, revenue from some of our early customers. So we couldn't really expand the team. Once we got the $3 million, you know, it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't a huge cushion, but it was a bit of a cushion. So we could expand the team here, we could expand the team in Pune, we could invest in our roadmap, and it was almost magical in that, you know, we really got a bump up from that. You know, and we started to have a lot more customers, a lot more license revenue with our migration product. You know, we ended up closing clients like Procter & Gamble through CenturyLink, Crayola through CenturyLink, HBO, Macy's. So we started to see a lot more license revenue. And, you know, we started to see a lot more traction in the market in 2013. And, you know, by the time we got to the end of 2013, you know, our board said, you know, you guys are doing really well. You've got named customers, license revenue, potential for, you know, growth within each of these clients. You know, however, you're not really spending as much money as you should to be able to take advantage of the market. We were really mostly investing in development, and we weren't really investing in the other areas we needed to. So they said, Sash, we understand you're capital efficient. That's great. However, we really think, you know, we should, you know, strike while the iron is hot. So why don't we do an inside round? And so we did an inside round in 2014, equivalent of $3 million. It was our existing investors. They gave us a new valuation, and we ended up closing that in, I believe, the summer of 2014. So,
and again, when you say license revenue, does that mean that you are not a SaaS company?
So we are not a SaaS company in that we don't host our software on cloud.
No, I'm asking more from a business model point of view. Are you not a subscription revenue company?
We are. We are a subscription company. So we are a subscription revenue company. When I say licenses, part of our product with migration is those are one-time licenses. Our disaster recovery product is a subscription license. That's recurring revenue. So our early days in 2013 was migration license revenue, which was, you know, more like a perpetual license. And then in 2014, we started to see much more disaster recovery and backup and the other product, which was subscription revenue.
And what kind of ARR are we talking when all this is happening, this, you know, inside around the funding, what threshold of ARR had you reached by this time?
I think we were still in the early days of, you know, ARR. So a percentage of our revenue that was subscription, I'll put it that way, was still less than 20% at that time.
I see.
But I think what our investors saw was the potential for more, and especially with some of our clients. So that's kind of what happened, you know, after we did the
interview. You were not being evaluated as a pure SaaS company. You had other kinds of revenues.
That's correct.
So there were plenty of customers and plenty of revenue, but not necessarily yet all subscription revenue.
That's correct. I think there was a potential that being there, it was starting to grow, but I think the client list and our traction in the marketplace was what was attractive to our current investors. But to your point, our objective was to continue to increase the subscription revenue, the recurring. And which is what we did. So in 2014, you know, we ended up closing some major partnerships with the additional investment. You know, we ended up closing an OEM deal. We won an RFP at CenturyLink. We won an RFP at IBM. We closed an OEM deal with IBM SoftLayer at the end of 2014. Mm-hmm. And then we continued to grow in 2015 with a partnership, you know, with VMware. And the VMware relationship, much of the IBM relationship was around recurring revenue. So even though, you know, 2014 less than 20%, we ended, you know, sort of 2015 in, I believe, the 20s as far as percentage of recurring revenue. And we continued to grow that in 2016. We ended last year around 35% of our revenue was recurring. And Q1 of this year, we ended north of 50% was recurring. We expect that to continue to grow. You know, so going back to the funding, you know, 2014 allowed us to grow. 2015 was a great year. We ended up landing, you know, additional clients like Stryker, Telstra, Bacardi. And we got to early 2016, and, you know, we had reached, you know, profitability, you know, but as you know, with a startup, it's about growth. And so we sort of sat there as a board and said, what do we want to do? Do we want to continue to operate as we are? We're capital efficient, we're profitable, we've got good clients. However, the market continues to grow, and we're starting to get bigger competitors. And so we said, is it time to do a bigger round? So we made a decision in early 2016 to go raise a Series B. And, you know, again, we wanted to target someone that was like-minded that had similar objectives as we did. And so we sort of really had a targeted approach to how we were going to do that round. And we ended up closing with Signal Peak Ventures, Ron Hines from Signal Peak, in August of 2016. And that has really allowed us to grow from a sales and marketing perspective, and we've continued to grow that team into this year.
What was the size of the round with Signal Peak? We had Ron just a few weeks ago, I think.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah, he's great. So we raised $10 million in the Series B.
Okay. So total, you've raised $16 million plus the LSI
right.
revenue.
Yeah.
That was $2
million
that has got you this far. Okay, got it. All right. So, and what of revenues? What, you know, what can you provide in terms of guidance
sure.
on revenue growth trajectory? You've provided very nice guidance on how your subscription revenue percentage has grown.
Yeah, so, you know, rather than talking about hard, fast numbers, you know, we've had, like I said, you know, customer revenue really, and I don't really count the LSI now, we could classify it. I really see 2013 as the first year, and we've doubled our revenue. We've had north of, you know, 100% growth, some years 150% year-over-year growth since 2013. Mm-hmm. We expect to be
okay.
the same. You know, in 2017. And again, to your point, our goal is around the subscription. We probably expect to be around 60 to 70% of our revenue will be recurring.
Mm-hmm. And you said that your competition was growing. Whom do you see in deals the most?
Yeah, you know, so it's funny because in the early years, our competition used to, you know, be smaller startups like ourselves. You know, we used to compete with like companies like Racimi or River Meadow or, you know, DoubleTake, you know, possibly PlaySpin, which is an older technology. We used to see them in deals in 13 and 14. We really don't see them in deals anymore from a migration perspective. We have a pretty mm-hmm. strong solution. Today, we are competing with larger players. We compete with Zerto. Zerto, just, you know, just to give you some perspective, they raised, I think, $130 million. I think they have several hundred in employees based out of Israel. So they raised a lot more money than us. We compete sometimes with VMware directly in deals. We've competed with Microsoft directly. And not that we win every time, but for a company smaller, we win more than we lose in most of these deals. You know, obviously we're smaller, so, you know, we're doing enterprise deals. So, you know, the question always is, you guys are smaller, how do we know you guys are financially viable? And, you know, we want to make sure you're going to last. That's the reason for our go-to-market strategy. You know, being capital efficient is great, but also, you know, it puts questions into minds of enterprise buyers. So we've kind of partnered with the, you know, some of the bigger players like IBM, some of the bigger players like CenturyLink and others, so that when we go into a large enterprise, it's not just about us. We have a big partner standing behind us. So it's allowed us to really kind of go after some of the bigger enterprises.
And who is the most likely to acquire a company like yours?
You know, it's definitely hard to say, but as you can see from, you know, what you're covering, there are definitely cloud wars, right? You know, Amazon's partner perspective is, you know, out into the right as far as a cloud player, but, you know, their footprint in the enterprise is still something that's probably a little smaller, and they're continuing to grow. Google wants into space so badly. They're trying to grow their cloud. Though they've had a cloud, it hasn't been sort of enterprise grade. I think they're continuing to put services and solutions and software to really enable the enterprise. There's obviously Oracle, you know, didn't get a great rating. Gartner, I know they want to grow. And obviously there's our partners, right? There's, you know, IBM SoftLayer, and then there's Microsoft. So all of these guys want to own a bigger piece of the pie. Part of how they're going to win clients is, how are you going to handle my enterprise? How am I going to be able to move these applications over? How am I going to handle managing these different clouds? I do not want to go into every portal. How do I manage governance? How do I manage compliance? How do I manage security? All of those things come into play. We've won huge clients with some of our partners. We continue to grow. We can deliver value to each of these cloud players. And I think, you know, one of these guys is going to want to own something like Rackware to be able to provide sort of a breadth management suite that allows clients to do the things they need to do, you know, as they move into the cloud. And that's, again, I think we're still early in the market from an enterprise perspective. It's going to continue to grow, and I think the war between these bigger players is going to continue to heat up.
Yeah, I will tell you one thing that I'm getting a bit concerned about is that we do have a lot of companies in the market that are heavily venture funded, very much more heavily venture funded than you, lots of companies. Yeah. Everybody will be looking for exits, and the IPO market can only take so much.
Right.
And then the acquisitions are only, there are only so few, so many acquisitions that these large companies can do. So, you know, how are all these companies going to get exits is going to become a relevant question for the venture capital industry at large, which is one of the reasons why we like capital efficient companies and companies that can be sustainable, profitable and sustainable over time, so that there are other, you know, other modes of exit that can be explored. Go on. Please finish what you wanted to say.
Oh no, I was just going to completely agree with you in that, you know, capital efficiency is just, it is so important. I mean, I know when, you know, if you're young, you're starting a company, you just get a ton of money. I think, you know, the natural thing is grow. But it's not just about how you grow your team. And if you're ready to go, the market has to be ready for you.
Yeah.
And there's so many other factors you don't control. You have to watch it. The ground can change under you. You have to be ever vigilant. You have to understand, you know, what it's going to be this quarter, next quarter, and the quarter, you know, beyond that. And being capital efficient gives you so much more freedom, because if you're not,
and profitable, being profitable gives you freedom as well. Being profitable gives you staying power. If you're dependent on investors to be able to survive, that is a very precarious situation when markets turn, and markets always turn.
They always turn. We don't control macroeconomic conditions, and you know that. I mean, crazy right now, and we don't know what's going to happen. You know, being able to sustain yourself is critical. When you cannot, your back is against the wall, and
that's
everybody
right.
can have your way with you. So I completely agree with you, and that's my number one advice to everyone. You know, that's watch the money, because that's your lifeline, that's your runway.
Sash, switching gears, one last question. You're a woman entrepreneur working in the hardcore depths of technology, and I love to see that. What has been your experience? Bias, discrimination, any challenge with the fundraising because of gender issues?
I think, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I grew up in HP, kind of went on to Brocade, you know, so I kind of rose through the ranks fairly easily. And I never felt any bias, you know, in bigger companies, you know, getting promotions and getting recognition. And from a customer perspective, not at all. I don't feel like I'm ever shut out of a room. You know, I don't think it's been challenging to build those relationships. However, the one wall I hit is raising money. I think there's definitely a bias. And, you know, I think it's strong in Silicon Valley. I do think there is a sense from venture capitalists to want to invest in people, you know, that may look like you, that may be like you, that have your background. I think people don't just invest in products, they invest in people, obviously, and the team. And that brings up bias. You know, when customers buy product, they judge the product ultimately. Obviously, if you can get a meeting if you have a friend and you have the network. But in other areas, I just didn't see it. I definitely, it was very, very, very challenging to raise money. Obviously, we're profitable. It's going to be a lot easier for me to go raise money if I wanted to. But, you know, in the early days, it's tough place for women in Silicon Valley. And I think the statistics prove, you know, what I'm saying. And I think, you know, going outside of the valley, that was part of the reason as well. You know, these guys are looking for good deals. They want good products. Enterprise software deals that are, you know, have potential, they're not that many. You know, so, you know, I don't think they cared whether I was a woman or not. So I think the bias is less outside of Silicon Valley. I still think it exists here. However, you know, you get through it. You know, it's a challenge, and you sort of, you know, climb that mountain, and you get to the other side, and you help more, you know, other women entrepreneurs do the same. I think that's how we solve the problem.
Interesting. I have a slightly different perspective on Silicon Valley's women entrepreneur issue, which is not exactly what you are saying. The competition for money in Silicon Valley is much higher, and investors see higher quality deals in terms of proof points. You know, so I think the time window that you're describing in Silicon Valley when you are going out to raise money, or you were going out to raise your first round, and the continuation of the first round, which you did an insider round anyway, investors in enterprise software were looking for SaaS deals.
Yeah.
And you were presenting them with a licensed software kind of model. It was not a SaaS deal. And if you want to raise a Series A in SaaS in Silicon Valley, investors are going to ask you to provide evidence of having achieved $1 million annual revenue rate. That is the norm, and it has been the norm for a while now in Silicon Valley. So what you are crafting as gender bias, I would encourage you to pause and think that maybe it wasn't gender bias, maybe it was just bias because you didn't fit what they were looking for in terms of what they wanted to invest in. And this is something I hear a lot from women entrepreneurs who get rejected, is that immediately they interpret the rejection as gender bias. And my take is that there's not always gender bias. There's also business bias. And please don't have this knee-jerk reaction that everything is gender bias if you're a woman.
I think, you know, that's a fair statement. However, I think we did show some level of growth, and the SaaS, you know, piece was there. You know, I guess the only thing is—
Did you have $1 million ARR in SaaS when you went out to raise money?
No, we did not. However, some of our competitors who went under did not either, and they were able to raise, you know, money from, you know, some of the VCs that we talked to. I get your point, though, however. You know, I don't think, you know, generally in my career it has been, hey, you know, if I don't get something, it's about me being a woman. I think anyone that, you know, knows me would say that. I think, you know, just some of the experiences that we had, and obviously it was a long road, right? So it wasn't just about sort of the business criteria. I agree with you. Generally, VCs are going to invest in a business model. That makes perfect sense. And,
business,
you know,
models and metrics. In our practice, what we have come to kind of institutionalize, so to speak, and this is for everybody who's listening, if you are doing today, if you're doing a software company, you're going to need to do it as a subscription revenue-based model, because that is the model that investors invest in today. If you're looking to raise money, if you're not looking to raise money, you can do whatever the hell you want to do. But if you are looking to raise money, that is the model that people invest in. And then there are specific, you know, milestones that you have to, metric milestones that you have to meet. You know, if you are sub-$1 million ARR, you're better off trying to get seed investors and not Series A investors. And there's a big difference between how seed investors operate and the Series A investors operate. So before you go out to raise a Series A, you're going to need to show $1 million ARR, which is about 80,000, a little over 80,000 a month in monthly recurring revenue. And you have to kind of hit that point and show that you know how to acquire customers. If you're not there, the likelihood of Series A investors, especially in Silicon Valley, but this is true everywhere now. It is not just in Silicon Valley. It's true outside of Silicon Valley as well. That is the one thing that people are looking for, is that can you do high velocity growth with the model, with the business that you're trying to raise money for? And this is, you know, something that you must remember, that, you know, male, female, you know, whatever be your skin color, if you actually deliver against the metric that they are evaluating you against, your chances of success are much, much higher.
I don't think I disagree with you, but, you know, I would caution that saying there's not a bias, I don't think is accurate. Just, I don't think the statistics bear that. So I agree with you. I think business metrics are what it's about, and I would encourage all women entrepreneurs to not let the stats, you know, prevent you from doing it. You know, we weren't at 1 million, but we were, you know, probably 50% of that, you know, when we started talking to people in 14. So we weren't so off, and I think some of our, you know, other competitors in the space didn't have it either. And I guess that was my only point. Having said that, it is what it is. You know, I do think business metrics are ultimately how all entrepreneurs are going to be judged, regardless of, you know, the sex or you know, the race or whatever it may be. So I tend to agree with you.
Well,
but I don't think we can just flush away the statistics saying that, you know, there are way fewer women entrepreneurs getting funded in the space, in my space.
But there are way fewer women entrepreneurs who go out to raise funding because there are way fewer women entrepreneurs who are doing startups. There are way fewer women entrepreneurs who are doing technology startups. There are a bit more who are doing kind of, you know, consumer type of stuff. But the kind of startup you are doing, there are way, 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 way fewer of those. So that, yes, there are statistics that fewer get funded, but there are also statistics that fewer exist, period. And the other point I will make is that there are different classes of VCs. Whom you are targeting and who's rejecting you is something that you have to consider. If you go after the wrong set of VCs who are not structurally be able to fund your stage, like if you have 50% of the 1 million ARR, there's a different set of VCs that you should be going to, or different set of seed funds, angel groups, et cetera, and not the same VCs who are likely to fund when you do have the 1 million ARR. So there's a whole, all I'm, the reason, Shtash, I'm pushing back on your comment is that I would like, you know, our audience who are listening to understand that this is a much more complex issue than brushing it off by saying there's gender bias. There is gender bias. I'm not saying that there's no gender bias anywhere. You know, Silicon Valley, especially in the engineers situation, as we are seeing in the Uber case and in several other cases, engineers are facing a lot of bias in the bro cultures and so forth. And I'm delighted to hear that you did not face that in your HP or Brocade careers. That's actually great. But I think the reason I'm pushing back is that there are a variety of different optimizations that you have to make in deciding how to raise money and, you know, the strategy of raising money. That's all.
Yeah, and I guess my last comment on this is, you know, you asked, I responded, you know, I just shared my experience. You know, I tend to agree with you that, you know, a lot of it is just about fit. Is it the right stage for that VC? Do they have another competitor that they're looking at? You know, have they already made too much investment in this space? There's a lot of factors that go into an investment, and I completely agree with you. And it wasn't a flippant comment of there was bias. It was just, you know, lots of years of experience, you know, in the industry and having talked to, you know, hundreds of VCs. That's only my experience, and I've obviously dealt with a lot of other women entrepreneurs in the space, and I've spent a lot of time in various forums. I just don't want us to say it doesn't exist, and I think you're not saying that. I'm just saying, and
no,
I totally,
I'm not saying that.
I know you're not saying that, and I'm just saying it's you're absolutely right. It's a complex issue, and I think the best advice you can give to entrepreneurs on the line is what you said. You know, target the right VCs, target the right space, be ready with the business metrics, be ready to show growth. I agree with everything that you said at that point.
All right, folks, we're going to go to the mentoring section of the program today. And this, remember, there's just a few things that I want to set expectations on, and then we're going to dive into your pitches. This is a safe working session. We have no other agenda but to help you, you know, with our feedback based on whatever situation, whatever questions you're coming to us with. And we are on your side. We have nobody else that we're trying to please, and we're not even trying to please you. You know, we're going to tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. So you will get critique, and be prepared for that. Now, what you do with that feedback is entirely up to you. If you disagree with our feedback, you can, you know, discard it and go do whatever you want to do. One thing to remember, not all businesses can raise money. Not all businesses should raise money, and raising money doesn't guarantee success. So if you are hard charging into fundraising without looking at the different variables that you have to consider on whether you are fundable or not, whether, what does it require for you to become fundable? Is your business, does your business have the characteristics of fundability? There's a lot of questions that you have to answer here. And, you have to basically create a very well thought through funding strategy, not a funding strategy that that is kind of off the cuff and you just go bumbling around and people are going to sign checks for you. It's very complex. The whole discipline of fundraising is extremely complex.